Welcome to Rockin' Your Prize. I'm your host, Dr. Alice Evans. Now, India poses a conundrum. Female labour force participation is around 25%, which is well below the global average. And the question is why? And some economists think that if only there was more economic growth, more job opportunities, just like East Asia, then women would flock to the cities, seize those jobs, and female employment would soar. But another possible explanation is maybe they're constrained by childcare or elderly care. So is it these home-based constraints? Or perhaps there's something in culture that women don't want to work, or men are uncomfortable with women working because they're concerned about wider social approval. Now, to test every single one of those mechanisms, there is a fantastic, an amazing, a brilliant new job market paper by Suhani Jalotta and Lisa Ho. And they're with me today to discuss their amazing randomized control trial in Mumbai. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Alice.
Okay, right. So now I've laid out why I think your paper is so important. Tell me what you did and how you've discovered it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us here. So in Mumbai, we run a randomized control trial with about 3,200 married households. And these are in Mumbai slum resettlement communities where we do three experiments with these households. There's a first experiment that's a primary experiment that we run. We randomly assign women into working from home or working from office-based jobs, where the offices are designed to be very specialized and they're right next to women's homes. They're women only, so it's very women friendly. And they also have childcare in these local offices. Now, we randomly assign women to the same, so the job type that women are doing from home and office is exactly the same. And this involves digital gig work that women are doing over their smartphones. Now, we also cross-randomize women into three different wage levels. So they could either be assigned to a low wage, which is about up to $60 a month, a medium wage, which is up to about $150 a month, and a high wage, which is up to about $300 a month. Mm-hmm. And so these women are assigned to either home at one of the wage levels or office at one of the wage mm-hmm. levels. So that's about six treatments. Mm-hmm. And we also randomly assign households into either receiving a husband survey or not, where we're essentially trying to understand whether or not knowing that my husband is going to be surveyed may affect a woman's take up of this work. So that's the main experiment. We also have two subsequent experiments that I'm happy to get into now or a little bit
later. We'll talk about them later. Okay. Okay. So I love this. So Lisa, can you tell me what you found?
Yeah, absolutely. So we find that work from home makes a massive difference to women's labor supply, women's take up of work. So working, offering jobs that can be done from home rather than from these offices about doubles job take up. And that's in comparison to very little difference that these increases in wages make. So even the kind of five times increase in wages makes zero difference to the take up of jobs when women can do the jobs from home. And from the office only increases job take up by around 7 percentage points.
Yes, I think this was such a fantastic aspect of your paper, the fact that you vary the economic rewards. Because you find in the between offering $150 a month to $300, and $300 being enormous for slum dwellers, you're showing that even when the income returns are higher, people still say no. And my explanation of that is this honour-income trade-off, that if people care about family honour depends on women staying at home in the sort of domestic sphere, then the economic returns clearly need to be even higher than 300 for people to budge. So that is a fantastic design element in your paper. So I really congratulate you both for that. Now,
thank you.
I
was just going to say, I think something that we thought was really interesting was that in comparison, when we offered these different wages to men, like men's labor supply responds in the way that we would expect. Like men are like their job take up increases massively when we increase wages by five times, which is kind of what we would expect. And I think what was really surprising is that women's labor supply didn't respond in the same way.
Now, the other great element that Suhani mentioned is that the offices provided childcare. But what about the idea that many people say that women just have a lot of housework? Because if you look at Indian surveys, the main reason that women say they're not taking up jobs is they've just got so much housework. Now, did you see any difference between women who have elder care or childcare?
Yeah, so when we look at whether or not women had young children, mm-hmm. We see that there's actually not much difference in take up of the office-based work. And when you look at elderly care, and those women that had more elderly caregiving responsibilities were in fact, if anything, more likely to take up office-based work. And that was surprising to us, but in qualitative work, we found that women were they thought the offices were like a respite from the heavy duties of taking care of in-laws at home, and they'd in fact like to actually go to the office and work from outside, where they had space just to themselves. So it doesn't seem to be this take-up difference between home and office doesn't really seem to be driven by caregiving responsibilities for women, which is often quoted to be the biggest constraint.
Absolutely. And this, if we talk briefly about methodology, I think this is such a fantastic insight of your RCT, because if you just look at the descriptive data, the reason why women say that they can't take jobs, they'll say it's housework. But there's this wonderful chapter on social norms in South Asia by Anukriti et others at the World Bank. And they show that in cultures where people think that women's primary role is in the house, women are more likely to do more housework, right? So if you believe that the loving mother, the caring mother makes ladoos and looks after people and is incredibly caring and warm and makes everyone a proper breakfast, then your volume of care is so much higher. Whereas if we're like, you know, I've met many women in Mumbai, a woman in Mumbai, the woman who made my earrings right now, she has this amazing jewelry shop. But she actually felt very, very guilty as a mother for not being at home with her children. Like if you hype mother into this really amazing thing that you're supposed to be this all-encompassing caring person, then your volume of care work that you have to do is very, very large. Absolutely. And it can give mothers psychological guilt. I've even spoken to Indian economists where they feel so bad about like going to a conference or working a long day at work. And that's cultural. Yep. So the final data, and I've got a lot of housework to do, that's partly how culture makes women feel, that there's a lot of stuff they've got to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And we saw this in West Bengal and I think in Mumbai as well. But basically, like, it seemed like for all women valued working from home to some extent, but women with more traditional attitudes valued working from home much more. And so it was like those attitudes basically amplified the importance of working from home for them, even though all women to some degree were valuing it.
Yeah, they were often told things like good wives don't work outside.
Yes.
Yeah. And a good mother doesn't leave their children and go outside. And so even though they're not explicitly even saying you're not allowed to work outside, a woman feels bad, exactly what you're saying. And so a woman, in fact, she doesn't reveal that she's not allowed. She in fact says, no, I'm allowed, but I think I would be a bad wife. It's like, okay, but why are you thinking that way? That it's essentially enforcing some sort of a norm that could be constraining them.
Definitely. And I think there's certainly an issue with social desirability bias, whereby if people are told, like, I think there's a lot of, you know, the onus, you know, in the past 50 years, there's this onus that it's good if the person if it's their own choice. So they go, I'm allowed to do this. This is my own choice. And therefore it's legitimate. So people like to frame things, you know, I've chosen to do them and therefore it's fine, right? Mm-hmm. As long as it's framed as her agency, her choice, it's fine no matter what she chooses. Mm-hmm. That's how some feminists analyze it. And I think that's such a good point. And what I wanted to also flag is, last week I was with Corinne Lowe, who's an economist over at New York, and she was showing that married women will do more housework in the US compared to divorced women. And that to me is interesting. You know, that can show that when you're a married woman, you may internalize these ideas that you've got lots of housework to do, especially if the husband is doing less. So these ideas that housework is culturally manufactured and it's in our heads, these are global things, right? So this is nothing specific to India. You know, all over the world, people can feel that you show love, you show care through, you know, doing lots of stuff at home. Yes.
Yeah. I think the difference though, like with the developed world and the developing world, where there was a recent from the Child Penalty Atlas.
Yes, by Levin et al. Yes.
Yeah, and The Economist, the graphic on the motherhood penalty versus the marriage effect, I think is really real, that in places like India, that really comes up in the papers that we work on, that it's really at marriage where the drop-off happens. Yes. But in a lot of the Western world, where in the United States, it's probably right after having a child, where a lot of the caregiving responsibilities become more forefront. But just being married means a woman is basically now not open and she needs to be secluded from anything else.
Yes, exactly. I was at the World Bank last week and I was saying to them, you know, if you want to raise female labor force participation, it's really important to understand regional or country specific binding constraints. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the Indian context, addressing childcare constraints, as you show in your paper, that's not the binding constraint, right? And it's really important, as you show in this paper, to show, you know, even if the office provides childcare, America, even if she herself doesn't have children, it's not going to make her, it won't budget. So that's, so like, if you're taking your hammer and you're throwing it at a bolt, that's not going to work. Yeah. So really bravo to both of you. Really, really bravo. Okay, so what I also found super, super interesting is that you first of all check how many women are taking these jobs just when you offer it to them. And what's the initial result just when the women are asked?
So we see close to 65 to 70% even for taking up the even the low wage to the high wage offers from home. Even and the difference between the home and office is not very large initially, in fact. So even for office-based work, I think the estimates are close to about 55 to 60%. But the big drop-off happens when we go back to the woman a few days later, and that's when we ask her again, so now can you actually work? Can you confirm? And we also ask, who else have you spoken to about this job offer, and what details have you shared with them? So that's when we find that the about 85% of the women had shared the details about the job with their husbands primarily. And then some others had also shared it with their neighbors and their mother-in-laws or their own parents. But most of the time, it seems that the women shared details about the job itself, like what the nature of the task was, not always the wage level. In fact, in the higher wage treatments, we actually found that women were more likely to hide the amount downplay it. And so they'd say that, no, I'm just earning like a little bit of money. It's like pocket money, so that he doesn't question her further about it. But anyway, we do find that the take up of the job drops off over time, and usually after discussions with other family members, usually the husband.
Yes.
And something that I thought was interesting as well is that when we offer them another job, like several months later, so I guess this is in West Bengal, the gap between what women accept and what women actually end up doing shrinks. So basically, like, one thing that was really surprising and at first kind of freaked me out is that in the treatment group in West Bengal, so the woman who had already had been offered a job once, their initial like stated interest or take up was lower than in the control group. But then in terms of actual take up later, like those equalized where the treatment group was actually slightly higher. So it basically seemed that in each of these cases, women were really over optimistic about whether they would be allowed to take the job and that they learned from asking their family that actually the constraints are stronger than they might have.
That's such a great observation about learning that stuff isn't allowed and then giving up.
Yeah.
That's such a nice observation.
And we see that happening a lot more with the, at least in the samples with Muslim women, where they were 30% more likely to drop out and then not again join again in round two. So like we essentially had now lower numbers of Muslim women joining in a round two work because they had learned, it seemed, from their experience.
Wait, slow down. So this is in the West Bengal sample?
This is in the Mumbai sample.
And West Bengal.
So so in both West Bengal and Mumbai, what is happening? What is happening that's different? Trace me through the religious differences.
So between the Hindu and the Muslim woman, we see that the take up in round one of the jobs is exactly the same.
Right. Okay. Very interesting.
So that was actually quite similar. We had expected and thought that it could be slightly different.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
But it seems that potentially most of the women had actually never discussed about their job or about working ever in a job with their husbands. And so they started doing this thinking that maybe they'd be allowed to do it if it's at home. Anyway, it's more convenient. But it seems that for Muslim women, they updated their beliefs after they, and that's why they seem to have dropped out, both from home and from office.
So were the Muslim women, was there a religious difference in receptibility in doing the work from home stuff? Were Muslim women less, after talking to their husbands, were the Muslim women less likely to do the work from home stuff?
Not at the initial take up. But they dropped out more, and then in round two were much less likely to take up the job.
So even the work from home?
Even the work from home. There was a larger difference with work from office, so that was a larger drop-off.
Right.
But there's still drop-off.
So the Muslim husbands were much more likely to say no to work from office?
To work from office.
Okay. And so you also, as I recall, asked men, right? Around 1,000 men, something like that?
Yeah.
Around 1,000 men, you know, what do you think of women working? What do you think other people in your community think of women working? And what did you find there?
So there we find that about 52% of the husbands, for when we asked them whether or not they'd mind their wives working in a job outside the home that was provided to the women, they actually were, they allowed their wives to work, but not if it was outside. So they said that, in fact, and this is amongst the progressive husbands, because it's very difficult in this context to actually get husbands to respond to surveys. The husbands that are responding to surveys, which was about 60% of all the husbands that we approached, these were the more progressive husbands.
How do you know that?
Originally we wanted to just survey everyone's husbands and then have like a complete husband and wife survey for everyone. But then I think like looking at the husband data from the pilot, it was like, oh my gosh, all the husbands, they have very progressive views. And then we realized, oh, actually they're just married to the most progressive woman. And so within couple is, in general, the woman has more gender equal views than the man, but they're also correlated. And so basically, like, the most progressive woman, we could get their husband's answer, we could get their husband's answer, and then once we got to a certain level of conservativeness, the men wouldn't answer anymore.
I wonder why that's correlated.
So the husband survey refusal was actually very correlated with a wife's refusal of taking up the job. So we find that if the husband refused the survey, she's almost definitely not continuing.
I wonder why that is.
And it seems that those are the husbands who are like, well, oh my God, like my wife, we don't talk about women's work.
Oh, right. Okay. Wow.
Traditionally,
wow. So it's just
acceptable to talk about it. Yeah. And so a woman, like, she shouldn't be engaging in this. So there were actually many wives who told us, "You please don't survey our husbands. Like, please don't do this." Wow. And so we would not. Mm. Even though they were assigned to the husband survey, we just couldn't do it because the wives didn't want that. And they did want to hide this. So about 7% of our wives in our sample hid everything about the job.
So what percent?
7%.
All right. Okay.
Like, they didn't even have any idea that they were working in this platform up until the very end.
But that isn't it. I mean, that itself is useful data that I think that is important data, that men did not want to do a survey specifically about women's work, right? Mm-hmm. Men did not want to answer a survey about women's work. Like, for me, that's telling you a lot about culture. Right? Yeah. You know, for the people who say, oh, you need more pipe water, you need more childcare. Yeah. If men won't answer a survey about women's work, like, that's a culture thumping you in the head, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, how much of a brain thump do you want?
Yeah.
Like, that's like, you, for me, you could publish a paper just with that. Husband's not refusal to talk about women's work.
Yeah.
Come on, I'm not crazy here. I'm not crazy.
We just don't know, how do we get less progressive husbands' views on paper ever? Like,
you've already got them. That's their revealed preference. Not answering your survey. You don't need them to say a thing. They've refused. That is great evidence.
I mean, something I was thinking for next time is, like, we approached the woman first, and so women first were opting into the survey, and so they kind of already knew what the survey was going to be about, and then we asked men, and I wondered, like, next time maybe we should, like, ask the husbands first. They feel like it's, like, their survey, and then we're like, okay.
But if the topic is women's work,
I think it needs to be, like, a small module.
But why, I don't know why you're worried that you haven't got the data. You've got the data. They don't want to talk about it.
We tried husbands first talking to them about something else, and then we got into the women's work questions, and then they quit the survey right there.
Boom, put this in the paper, in the paper. Yeah. You know, I can talk to them about these topics, you know, whatever. Yeah. I can talk to them about house prices. I can talk to them about whatever, local governance, BGP, whatever.
Yeah, actually, and that's also what's interesting, and this is kind
Seriously, you should put that in the paper. I don't remember you saying that in the paper. Put it explicitly.
Okay, yeah, we'll definitely include that.
How is this not data? This is great, especially if you have it that they stopped talking the minute you talked about women's work.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. Yeah, that you two are underestimating your own brilliance. This is the Alice Evans Empowerment Class. Oh. It's starting with you two.
And you know, what's interesting is from some of the work that Leo Burstein and others do about how gender norms are perceived around the world, they find that a man in Saudi Arabia, at least, is privately okay publicly not okay. But actually, in this case, it seems to be pretty much the reverse, where if you ask these men about their perceptions about women's work, they're actually open to talking about it. They're just not open to talking about it when it comes to their wife's work. So they're like, yeah, women today can do anything. They can be astronauts. They can do this. They can do that. But my wife can't do it. Why? Because she's not knowledgeable, or we don't come from this community, or like no woman in my family works. My sister also doesn't do this. And so I think that distinction is pretty, and that's unique. And we are trying to understand, why is that?
But I think for me, this is very obvious, and it's not obvious to some people who don't understand, you know, gender relations properly. But if you think about it, that men's honor depends on female seclusion. So your honor as a man, right? So it's about how women's work affects how other people see you. Mm-hmm. And this is something that Claudia Goldin talked about in 1994, the idea that the men gained pride as breadwinners, and it was stigmatizing if their wife was going out to work versus it was shown their failure to provide. Mm-hmm. So if your identity as a man is wrapped up in being a provider, that doesn't mean you're necessarily going to oppose some woman being a teacher, an astronaut, yeah. whatever. Yeah. A chairman, fine.
Yeah.
But it's about you being unable to provide in the US context that Golden talks about. Exactly yeah, the same. Right. So we shouldn't think about, you know, so for me, those surveys, yeah. it's just that they don't, you know, maybe, you know, these people are not understanding gender. They think, do you support yeah. female employment? Yes or no. They're not thinking about how does it affect, you know, men's concerns about how they're seen by the wider community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people, you know, especially in close-knit communities where people can gossip, where people spread rumors. You know, there's that wonderful book on Mumbai, Why Loiter, which is all about this idea that, you know, women shouldn't loiter at cafes. They shouldn't hang out at cafes because people say, what was she up to? Who was she talking with? Oh, did you see she was talking yeah. with those boys? Right? Yeah. And that reflects badly on the man.
Yeah.
And it's the, and I bet... You are not, you know, if you speak to the average guy in Mumbai, you say, you know, can women go to cafes? They'll say, of course, right?
Yeah.
But would you want your wife and daughter to be just hanging out and, you know, loitering in the streets? No, that's not, you know, it would look badly. So I think that's why we need to be careful, you know, in honor cultures where women's behavior reflects badly on the men in their family.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you have this sort of more closer policing, etc.
Yeah, absolutely true.
Okay, so now we are going back to I think you're finding two really interesting things. So, well, sorry, there are so many, but in this particular aspect of men, one is that men predict disapproval. So men are concerned mm-hmm. that other people will think badly of them.
Mm-hmm.
And also the other element is so important that perhaps maybe you could highlight more in the paper. Is that, you know, women are deferring to their husband's authority.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That seems to be a major mechanism. So, you know, almost 3/4 are originally saying yes,
mm-hmm.
and then the husband says no, and the husband has the final say. And that's consistent mm-hmm. with, we know, like DHS
yeah.
data on marital control.
Yeah, I mean, I think when we ask women who has the final say in your job decision, only around 1/3 say that they have the final say
mm-hmm.
themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's even probably a bit over-optimistic
yes.
as well.
Yeah, by their revealed preferences,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, this goes back to what I was saying about social desirability bias. Like, if there is a culture whereby it's seen as good to say, you know, I made this decision, this is all me, I decided to do this,
yeah.
then you may overestimate how much decision, you know, lots of people might say, you know, I'm, you know, doing stuff on my own, I've made these choices, this is on me, etc. And
yeah.
that's just a sort of cultural ideal.
Yeah.
But when it comes down to it, clearly we're seeing that the women are deferring to their husbands. They're letting,
mm-hmm.
and like when you, and you see this in several ways in your data, both implicitly and directly, like when women are saying, please don't ask my husband, because they're worried about their husbands getting upset.
Yeah,
like if
yeah.
women are begging you not to even
yeah.
talk to their husbands about
yeah.
this is showing real concern about patriarchal backlash. Or when you were saying earlier, Suhani, about, you know, women keeping the exact amount from their husbands or saying it's only going to be pocket money. There's a paper by Reed 2021 shows in India women who out-earn their husbands are very, very high risk of violence, right?
Mm-hmm.
When male
yep.
status is jeopardized. So this is
yeah.
so much about the idea that, you know, women need to please their husbands, that the husband should have the final say.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think this is something that, you know, we need to theorize more
mm-hmm.
is that it's not just... That, you know, for me, the cultural constraints is twofold. It's one, that male honor depends on female seclusion. And it's this other idea, and I think related to the caste system, that if trusted networks are consolidated through marriage, so that daughter is socialized to marry,
mm-hmm.
to stay put, and she cannot leave, and divorce is totally prohibited. And in Maharashtra, divorce is around 1%.
Mm-hmm.
So if divorce is totally prohibited, she cannot leave. So the husband
mm-hmm.
knows he can say whatever she likes, and she has little wriggle room,
yeah.
very little wriggle room. And so that's another really important element of female labour force participation. So like, you know, donors, they might think, oh, we just need to empower these women or we need to offer income generating activities. That's not going to address this binding constraint where the
mm-hmm.
husband, his status depends on him being the breadwinner, and he is given the final say over whether she gets work. Like for me, you've got to address all these different different cultural elements.
Yeah.
And like, you know, when we say social norms, you know, social norms aren't one big thing. They're not a black box. We can be very, very specific. Just because we're talking about norms doesn't mean we can't be specific. We can identify every single one
yeah.
of these causal mechanisms.
Yeah.
And I, the reason why I will say again this, I love
yeah.
you two so much, is because you show each of these very explicitly, that you enable us to see, aha, it's that causal mechanism, it's this one, right?
Yeah.
This is why you are so brilliant. Yes. Okay. Tell me more.
I was just going to say something about how, and I mean, obviously India has like, is very heterogeneous in terms of like exactly how patriarchal different areas are. But something that struck me is I think people told me, oh, West Bengal, it's going to be very gender equal relative to other parts of India. And I think to some degree that is true, but it also, people kind of had pride in like, I feel like a lot of women had pride in saying like, oh yeah, I do make my own decisions. But then when we actually asked them, okay, so like if you were going to buy this, would you ask your husband for permission first? A lot of the time they said, well, I mean, we don't really need his permission, but I would inform
yes, him. Yes, yes.
And so there was like a whole nother category that we opened up that was like inform. And like, to what degree is that really like, how is that different from asking for permission? It was a little bit unclear, I think.
That's a good point. Wait, I want to say one more thing about the Mumbai paper, and then I want to talk about the West Bengal. So I think, so what is your big takeaway from the Mumbai paper?
So the main policy takeaway really is that many of the policy addressable things that we can do, like providing childcare facilities, providing safe office spaces, office spaces right next to women's homes, they seem to, in this context where these norms are so strong, they may have limited impact, and that in fact home-based jobs may be the most immediate path to increasing the female labor force participation, to at least get women to start entering the sort of work. And then over time, potentially, and we hope at least that this type of work can even shift norms such that women can then maybe start stepping out of the house as well more. And that's the ultimate goal, is that it's not enough to just provide childcare and think that that's what's solving the female labor force problem in India. It probably can't.
Is that your big takeaway too, Lisa?
Yeah, absolutely.
You two are really gunning for this home-based labor stuff.
Oh,
it makes me upset. You know it makes me upset.
Well, so I think, I mean,
come on. Now the gloves come off.
Yeah. Well, okay. So I think like one potential downside of home-based work is like, well, what happens if women get stuck working from home and now they don't have the option of working outside the home because men can say, oh, well, you can earn income from home. Why do you need to step out?
Right.
So I think that is something that we've been concerned about and have talked about a lot. I think for the woman who cannot step out in any case, and so this is the only way for them to have independent income, to me, that's still like an improvement. I think for thinking about eventually like, okay, well, if we want women to have an equal role in public life and that we want them to be stepping outside the home, what does that look like kind of on a policy level? I think one thing that it seems like employers could potentially do, a lot of employers seem very interested in hiring women and have been asking like what kind of amenities they can provide for women. It seems like if they provide like home-based trainings or an initial short-term period where the woman is working from home and then they say there's no longer a home-based option, now you have to come to the office, that's still a helpful like stepping stone. But I think it's definitely a very legitimate concern that women could get stuck working from home. I think that needs to be provided more as a stepping stone that's then taken away as an option. But as long as, even if it's just there in the short term, it seems like that allows the family to kind of adjust more slowly, and that seems to be helpful instead of just the option of getting work just being shut down immediately and then women seem to give up.
Yeah. And I think the other just important thing to highlight here, which is again reiterating some of the things that we've just learned in the paper through our results, is it's women are not just constrained by having little kids, and it's not that they don't have time to work and that maybe they're not willing to work, which are all these things that come up as to why women in India are not working. It seems that they actually, especially in urban India, they actually may have more time. Mm-hmm. They are using a lot more household appliances. There are ways of managing the childcare as well.
Yes.
But even then, they're not working in some ways. So I think we need to realize that somehow they are stuck at home. Like they are confined.
Yes,
culturally confined. And so this Parda norm of like just having that veil, like a gungat, where in northern India, you see this more obviously, where they're still burying the veil. And here it's like a kind of a figurative veil. Like you're still you're secluded from outside world. Mm. So we need to somehow get the woman exposed to the outside world somehow and make her confident and more like stand on her own two feet in some way. We think that this intervention is able to provide her with some income with a white collar type job, which is dignified, so it doesn't bring down her dignity in any way, and could potentially give her the confidence to be able to do other things. But there are other ways of providing the sort of exposure to women as well, while understanding that they can't jump steps because they are pretty confined, and especially the more vulnerable women are even more confined. So if you really need to get them to do a paid work, if they want to, then we really need to be thinking about solutions beyond just getting them outside immediately.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess I just think it's too big an ask in a lot of cases to immediately say, okay, now you have to spend all this time outside. I think many of the women in our study wouldn't have wanted that even though they want some kind of field work.
So I run an organization in India focused on women's empowerment, and even for women's health sessions. So we host sessions where those are located in those women's own communities, and we just ask them to come and learn about their own health, like sexual reproductive health. And women aren't allowed to leave homes to come for a session about their health.
Tell me about this.
And this is like about, so this is about their periods and about sexual reproductive health. It's slightly stigmatized. And many women are like, what will I tell my household members too? Like, what am I going out for? So I can't say, so I have to kind of hide and go. My household members also don't allow me to come for this.
Is this in Mumbai?
This is in Mumbai, in the same communities. And so we have to drag like the girls to come to a session to learn about their own health, where they get free sanitary napkins, where they like get free things too. But those are honestly like ways to incentivize them to come out because they're not coming out otherwise.
Wow.
And at home, we can't provide this information because there's male members and there are other people and they're so shy to even open up about this. So employment is like a next level. Like this is where you're actually bringing in money that could threaten something.
I didn't know. You know, Anukriti has this a couple of papers on something very similar, whereby the mother-in-law in Uttar Pradesh is restricting the girls, restricting the daughters-in-law from growing out and learning things about family planning. And then what they do is they have an intervention where they give them some kind of incentive, some kind of token, if you come with a friend, because it's their way of boosting female friendships.
Right.
But still, there are these massive constraints. So in the families in Mumbai, do you know who is... Who are the women who aren't allowed? Is it teenage girls? Is it women in their 20s who are stopping them, husbands or mothers-in-law?
Even unmarried girls, actually, are especially unmarried girls of marriageable age, are restricted from coming. I remember once we had a session where we were talking about the three holds that a woman has, and we had all these unmarried girls like just step out and just leave. They're like, how dare you show us an image like this? Like, this is completely obscene. Like, we can't.
The girls were upset about it.
The girls were upset. And like the older women there were upset that we were showing this in front of them. So, like, essentially, the married woman is more acceptable for married
women.
When
you say holes, should we be explicit and say vagina?
Oh, yes. Right. Yes.
Weren't you also saying, like, once you got married, you were, the woman in the community were like, oh, now you understand.
Yeah. I was just telling that. I mean, I just got recently married.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
This is obviously the greatest moment in a woman's life, right? Congratulations. No, bravo. And you have a beautiful ring there, Suhan.
Thank you. Yeah, my husband designed
this. And I met your husband two nights ago. Yes.
So he listens to your podcast. And he listens to your podcast.
So we'll give him a shout out to him.
But this is when the women actually, when they found out that I'm married, is when they start to feel like they can relate to me more and they can open up about certain things that they wouldn't be able to with unmarried women. And even as the nonprofit leader in this space and working on this, but they weren't opening up to me as much before. But I think that these kinds
of just to clarify, do you think that's because it was now appropriate for them to share things? Like, it was now accepted that you would
that
know
I
about
could
these.
Hear.
Yes,
yeah.
Right.
Like,
otherwise, we must shield you.
About,
yes,
yeah,
yes. We
about
must protect. We must protect the innocent Suhani, right? But now Suhani is mature. Now she's allowed to know about these things. And now she's allowed.
Unmarried women are so protected. They're protected so much that they have no clue what they're getting into.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that creates a whole host of other issues because now they have no exposure to the world. They're not allowed to step out to come to these sessions about their health, and there is no health training provided in schools.
Yes, of course.
So they don't learn this anywhere.
But even that's such a great anecdote, because if people are unwilling to talk to unmarried Suhani, that's showing that really an unmarried Indian woman is just not supposed to be getting this knowledge.
Is not supposed to.
Why do you think there's this norm about women learning about reproductive health? Like, why do you think that's such a taboo?
There is the whole promiscuousness and dignity that comes with, that a woman holds of the family.
Yes.
Comes with a woman being untouched, untainted until marriage.
Yes.
So she should get married off pure.
Right.
And then after marriage, like, then the husband and then that family takes care of everything.
Yes.
But up until then, like, she's my responsibility and she's not going to get married if there's any stain on her dignity.
Yes, exactly, right.
And I think it's like, it's that, I've seen in my own family.
Yes.
They were very concerned, like, we couldn't live together. Like, we were very concerned, you cannot. Like, there's this clear distinctions because nobody in the family, and that it really, the external perception matters so much. What does the community think? And that determines what your dignity is and your value in yes, the family.
Yes, absolutely. And I think this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, right? So if you have a community whereby the family honour depends on the woman's purity, mm-hmm. right? So that may mean you may limit her access to reproductive knowledge and limit her access to going to cafes and to getting jobs. But it's perfectly permissible. It's logically consistent to hold those attitudes and also to say women in general can work. So going back to those surveys, that's why for me, these things, to other people, they don't. But to me, that's how you can make sense of it, right? Yeah. Right, okay. Totally. Okay, so this is brilliant. So bravo. And thank you for sharing that. And let's just say, let me just congratulate, you know, this is a massive organizational feat, what you have pulled off in Mumbai. Like, I know that is an enormous volume of work and organizational labor.
I mean, Suhani, like, has her own entire empire. Empire.
That's made this possible. Honestly, yeah. It's such a big team. It really wouldn't have been possible without that. And the community trust, I think, yes, is so important to be able to build these offices mm-hmm. and for the people to trust these offices. It takes a lot. I think that's where the NGO and the established reputation really helped.
Really, yeah. Bravo. I cannot praise you enough and congratulate you enough for, you know, building trust. And it takes a long time. And, you know, you can only build trust where people show that you want the best for the community and you're trying to help them, and when they've seen tangible results on the ground.
Right.
So that's something to be really proud of.
Yeah.
So bravo, really, truly. Okay, but now is where I turn into a total bitch and disagree with you, okay?
Excited.
I give a joke tomorrow and I take it back, right? Okay. Listen. So you were saying earlier two things that struck me. So you were saying, you know, home-based work can be a stepping stone and also women need confidence to step out into the wider world. But, you know, if we look historically, in like the 1911, 1920s, when the mills opened up in Calcutta, Bengali women would work from home at like a third of the wage, showed Tithanka Roy. So there's been this very long history of women foregoing the income-generating opportunities in the mills, in the jute mills, in textile places. Similarly, in Pakistan, you know, women would forego those economic opportunities in garment factories and work from home for a far lower wage. And so for me, and there's lots of papers in Lucknow showing, you know, women doing home-based manufacturing. So I think, you know, Indian, and I've interviewed women in little towns in Rajasthan, they're doing this embroidery work. So for me, I see women as doing home-based productive work for an incredibly long time, mm-hmm. some of it remunerated, some of it not, some of it just contributing to household survival. And for me, like, the big implication of your paper, the two implications I was highlighting earlier, is that male honor depends on female seclusion and women obey their husbands. Women doing home-based work mm-hmm. doesn't seem to address either of those two binding constraints, that men's honour depends on female seclusion and women obey their husbands. And that is why, that is how I would interpret it, throughout, you know, from hundreds and hundreds of years, women may have done home-based work, but still you're not addressing any of those two binding constraints. So why would we expect change? You know, some people just say, oh, you know, things will change with time. But unless you see structural shifts, unless things actually happen in those time periods, then why expect rupture or disruption? So I just don't know whether women coding from home, if men's honour, if people still care about what others will say, if men's honour still depends on women's purity, women may still be doing that work from home and staying at home, you know. And so much of this, people, well, may still be heavily reliant on caste networks, heavily concerned about what others think of them. And if you never see women stepping outside the home, you may still think that it's inappropriate. So if all the women are doing home-based work, everyone may be trapped in this collective action problem whereby only the loose or desperate or, you know, financially precarious families are doing it. So we don't want our daughters to do it because then they may become unmarriageable or something like that. So you have these collective action constraints that reproduce the status quo. And especially, you know, on the issue of divorce, right? So, you know, with home-based coding, fine, there is an income there, but it's not enough for a woman to go out it alone. You know, she won't be able to afford housing in Mumbai, right? And moreover, even bigger, is that divorce is a total, total shameful taboo, and it's the worst thing in the world, and some families won't even hear about it. You know, I'm sure if you did a survey on divorce, a lot of people say, I am not answering that survey, not. Right? Yeah. Right? That would be my data point. Okay. So as long
3%
as...
3% answering.
Yeah, we could not get anyone to answer the survey, right?
And they didn't just heard it.
chase you out. Okay, so my point is that, you know, as long as divorce is impermissible, then the husbands will have de facto the final say, even if they do not articulate that directly. And then you are still in that same situation. And so even if home-based production may be good for, you know, economic productivity, home-based survival, you know, economic contributions, building up the labor force, I don't know if it would change gender relations. And then you're also saying, you know, that, you know, women need more confidence to step outside. And I just don't know whether it's a confidence issue, because if in your initial survey, almost 3/4 of the women are accepting those jobs, that shows they want them. So the women's confidence is not the binding constraint. The binding constraint is men's attitudes and women's obedience to men, as I would see it.
I mean, I do think, so I think we've talked a little bit about what would happen if home-based work became sort of a permanent option.
Yes.
And I do think it's true that there could be negative impacts for the woman who would otherwise be working outside the home and are now drawn to working from home.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it still opens up the opportunity for earning income for these women who previously had so little control over any kind of income in their lives. So I guess that is a trade-off, and I don't exactly know how to weigh those and come up with like a final, like, is it good or bad? I do still think that the idea of having home-based work or home-based training that's temporary and that's then taken away but is offered as like an initial step towards a job that's outside the home still seems quite effective, and that would be something that would be nice to be able to test with an employer who has like an office-based job that's going to be there for the long term, so we can see if women actually stay, because we do see that women are more likely to take our office-based job if they first worked.
Rudely, outrageously. No, now we need to go into this West Bengal paper. Yeah. So tell me all about the West Bengal paper.
I mean, so one, I guess the West Bengal paper has some of the same, I would say, takeaways from the Mumbai paper, in that we also find that work from home doubles job take up. So that is the same across from West Bengal to Mumbai. And in settings with very different stated attitudes, we still find that work from home makes this enormous difference to a woman's take up of jobs. We then also have
a section. Give me the numbers. So so you offer them home-based work for doing digital coding.
Yes. Yeah, so
and what percentage?
48% start the work if they're doing the work from home.
So hold your horses.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
What percentage of women take up work from home?
That's the 48%.
Yeah. And is that the same with Hindus and Muslims?
I think they were not statistically different. Yeah.
And then how later is it that you offer the home-based jobs?
So like 3 to 4 months later.
Uh-huh.
When those initial jobs have come to an end, because those initial jobs were just 1 month,
mm-hmm.
we come back to all of the participants who were either offered a job mm-hmm. initially, or they were in the control groups, they weren't offered any job, and we offer them another set of jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those jobs are digital work from home, some of those are digital work from an office,
mm-hmm.
some of those are non-digital work mm-hmm. from home, some of those are non-digital work mm-hmm. from the office, and we find that the women who were initially offered the work from home jobs are more likely to take the office-based jobs than the control group women who had no initial offer.
How much more likely?
6 percentage points.
How much is that?
That's the intent to treat, and the take up for the office based or the home based work was only like 48%. So I guess if we took the treatment on the treat, it would be something closer to like 12%, which is substantial.
So what percentage of women finally took up the office based jobs?
At the end, like 25%.
So it's still really low. So
It's still really low, but these are starting with women who had no...
But wait,
like,
hold your horses. So if a woman had not done the work from home before,
yeah.
what percentage of those women take
so
up
like
office
15%.
Jobs? 15%.
Yes.
So if she's never done work from home and she's
yeah.
just offered an office job,
mm-hmm.
15% say yes to the
yeah.
office job. But if she's done work from home and then she's offered the office job, it's 25%
yes.
say yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so that is
that's
a big jump. Wait,
yeah.
so that sounds like... That sounds like you're doubling, almost doubling.
Almost,
it.
Yeah.
That's big. That is
yeah.
big. That is big.
So that is, a big effect considering how low the take-up is.
So that seems that your final result of take-up in office jobs
mm-hmm.
is much lower in West Bengal
it
than
is.
In Mumbai?
Well, so in Mumbai, the offices are so much more appealing. Like, you can bring children, they're in, like, the same communities, they're so much easier to get to. In West Bengal, they were trying to make it a little bit more like what would
a typical office
look like.
So you're
they're
so clever.
More like often 15, 20 minutes away. You can't bring your children. And so there's a bit more, it's, I guess, more like what a normal office would be like.
15 minutes walking?
In the urban areas, like less than 15 minutes walking, but we were also working in some rural areas.
Like, if I had a 15 minute commute, I'd be happy.
But, like, I think for most of these women, that's still, like, further than they generally go. Like, this is still, like, kind of an outing that is unusual for them.
Yeah.
So, a 15 minute walk and you can't, I mean, that's like a typical job, right? A 15 minute walk and you can't take your kids.
Yeah, absolutely.
And only 15, and with the West Bengal, I apologize. Yeah. What's the salary that you're offering them?
We're offering them somewhat similar. I mean, it's more like 50 USD per month, so it's slightly less than Mumbai, but also, like, the cost of living is lower.
Right,
so.
Of course. Yes. Mumbai is very expensive. Okay, but wow, only 15% are taking up those office jobs.
Yeah.
So that's really low.
Yeah, so we compare the take up of the typical office jobs that we see from West Bengal with the local office, the female friendly local office jobs, and we see that there's almost a double take up because it's 15%, it's 27% from these local offices. And then we can 4x the typical office take up to about 48 to 56%, which is 56% is what we find for home based take up in Mumbai, 48% in West Bengal. So comparing the typical office to the home base. So it seems that at each step we can, so even just practical constraints, the providing childcare, local offices, safe office spaces, can double the take up from 15 to like almost 30. But then to make it, to increase that any more, we can't pay women more. It doesn't seem like financial incentives is not what's going to convince them.
Right.
It's maybe this, some sort of flexible work, maybe at home, where location seems to matter. And I think to your point about, like, your criticism.
Yes, Alice Benibich,
What do you think? Yeah. What do you think about hybrid models where a woman is working from home maybe 2 days a week and in an office 3 days a week, something of that sort? Because that's something that we've been considering a lot, that might match both, like, best from both worlds sort of a thing.
The thing is, I guess that the question is, like, as a policy implication or is it, you know, what we want to do is know what would create effects at scale.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're asking me, Alice, what kind of intervention would work? Yeah, sure, maybe a hybrid model would work. But we can't have a policy model that would create hybrid work. Like, we can't just tell employers you should do hybrid work because we don't have, like, lots of Indian offices that are listening to us. I mean, if you are an Indian employer and you're listening to this podcast, overestimate my influence on Indian employers, right? You know, 70%, I mean, we've got to be realistic here, right? 77% of Indians work in firms employing less than 10 people, right? Indian firms are overwhelmingly tiny.
Yeah.
I mean, that's another thing that we should be careful about. Yeah. You know, you're talking about, you know, you still said that was the typical firm. To be honest, it's not, right? The typical firm is not a big sanitized office with, you know, their regulations and public spaces and people being it's kind of like a band of guys behind a small door, right? Now, I was in, you know, Suhani, I'm sure you spent a lot of time in Dharavi and places like that. You know, when you go through Dharavi, there are these little corridors and you'll open a door and there'll be like a low-lying ceiling and it's a dark room and there are these, let's be honest, like sweaty guys all with their different machinery, right? You've got five guys in a little room. You go to another place and it's a bunch of little, you know, those are what most workplaces are like, right? They're kind of dirty and it's just mostly men and it's a few people, you know, even in a fancier place like a photocopier office, right? You know, I'm just saying, you know, realistic jobs, right? These are still small firms, you know. Amit Basoli has this wonderful paper on structural transformation in India, and he makes the case that, you know, India's growth has been driven by these very, very high productivity superstar sectors like fire or whatever, finance, insurance, retail, whatever, real estate, whatever. And those firms are super, super productive, but they're not employing so much labor, right? So most of the people remain in the informal economy. They remain in these very tiny firms and the productivity is very low. And so wages are very low. And this creates a negative feedback loop because those people don't have that much money to spend on goods and services. And so they're not creating additional labor demand. They're not creating additional jobs. So even your 15-minute work office, that's a kind of fancy place.
That's a kind of fancy place. Very nice job relative to the other options, and there's still very low take up for that.
But so from the in Mumbai, we also tried out non-digital work jobs. Okay. So a little bit more typical.
Yes.
So bangle decorating, for instance, is like a very common thing that people do in a lot of these slums. And there are actual offices as well that you can come and do this work. Or you can take the bangles home and do it from home and then just bring them to the office. When we offered women both of these, this is a pilot, this is a few years before, we saw that the take-up overall was much lower than for the digital work amongst women that were not employed.
Oh, right.
So they preferred the smartphone-based job.
Do you think that's because it sounds fancier and like...
I think it's the because we were looking at the middle-skilled population, right? That's the skill that we need to cater
for. Yes, yes, yes. That's where female employment is very low. Really yes, low. Yes. Exactly. Like high school-educated women. Right. Yes, okay.
So for the high school-educated women, doing the sort of bangle decorating, piecery, that kind of work is a little bit...
Beneath them. Yes, yes.
And for their families.
Yes.
And so that's the blue-collar work that they're even less likely to be allowed to do than this sort of work. And so I think that was one thing we thought. And then the difference in take-up between the bangle office job and the bangle home job was also a lot larger. So there was only 5% of women who ended up accepting the office-based work and starting it. And for the bangles from home was about 22% or something like that. So the difference was also larger between home and office, but overall was lower take-up. So we take your point on that, like, digital job is likely a fancier type of work. And you're trying to figure out...
Like, when we did... we tested some non-digital jobs in West Bengal, too, that actually had similar take-up rates to digital jobs, but I think it was because they don't have, like, these associations with, like, blue-collar work. Like, they were doing some sewing that... they were sewing masks, and this was, like, post-COVID. And so it was, like, also something that I think felt not, like, associated with a particular kind of, like, class that's below them, if that makes sense.
Right, right.
Yeah.
But I think, like, so in general, providing sustained work and figuring out what is the future of this work that we can provide to women, I think that's a question that we're trying to grapple with and trying to figure out. I think you make a really good point that these small informal businesses, what is the scope for employment there? And we don't know if there's any...
Like, just imagine how much gossip there would be. Like, you know,
yeah.
A woman, like... If people say, you know, she is going to that little place and there is just like 7 brothers there or a cousin and an uncle, she's just with those men. It's all behind closed doors.
Yeah.
You know, what are they doing? And, you know, those men cannot be trusted. And, I don't know about this. Whereas like in the public sector or government job, people are less likely to suspect impropriety. There's a more of an acceptance of...
I mean, I think like the woman-only office spaces was... like everything for us was woman-only office spaces because if there hadn't been woman-only, then we would have had like zero take-up.
Yes.
Let me
give a shout out to Gaurav Chaplunka and Penelope Goldberg. They got a paper on women entrepreneurs and they find that women's reservation wage is lower for a female-owned enterprise. So that women will be more happy to work for a women-only firm. And that makes sense, but then the policy implications are very difficult. Like, do you have a quota or a tax incentive for female entrepreneurs? And you may just get the situation where men register it in their own name, right? Oh, yeah, like, I'll take the quota, yeah, this is my wife's company, sure. Right? So I think that's a dangerous game.
I mean, something that was kind of interesting for us as well was, like, for the speech-based tasks, sometimes, like, at the beginning, we would listen to make sure that it was the woman doing the task and not just, like, her husband is, like, taking over the job from her. And we did find sometimes that husbands had just, like, taken over and were doing, like, the voice. And then we would kind of go to the house with, oh, by the way, like, so who is doing the tasks? And then after, like, we would talk with them a little bit and... It would come out that maybe
why do you think the husband tasks. Why do you think the husband would do some of the tasks?
I think why did he want
so to some of the husbands told us that can you just give us this job, like we leave our actual jobs and just do this type of work because it seems like it's really basic skills.
A cushy job.
Exactly, it was a cushy job. But we found that we asked women the type of work if we had offered them like call center work, which is basically like this digital work, but that involved them talking to men or strangers on calls, inbound or outbound.
Yeah.
They thought that was as lowly or as undignified as vegetable selling on the streets.
Are you joking? Where is this? When did you do this?
In the same survey, actually, we just haven't added to the paper.
Yeah.
Oh my God, you have got so many gold nuggets that you are keeping from me. Why are you keeping it? This is so brilliant
just
stuff.
Just keeping it from you.
So mean. Why are you so mean to me? No, this is so, you know, like I was saying before, you two are brilliant, and then I didn't know that you had all this extra secret stuff. You are amazing. Okay, tell me more.
So call center type of work, it seems like it's considered just really undignified because of the idea that
What's the data?
Like what? So we had I think like less than 10% of women in our data who were accepting to do call center type of work, similar to the statistic that we see for domestic help and vegetable selling. And then the more acceptable type of jobs that more than 50 or 60% of women said they would be allowed to do by their husbands were things like teaching, clerk, desk office jobs.
So wait, the call center, so amazing.
But call center, yeah, that was really...
But wait, hold the horses. So was this offering women the call center jobs and women's initial acceptance, or was this after talking to the husbands?
This was just like interest, right?
This
like
was, whether this they was understanding whether they felt that they would be allowed by their husbands to work in X type of job.
And that's that you're not even going to meet those. I mean, that totally tracks that in India and much of the Middle East and North Africa, there's women very low women's workforce participation in the service sector. Like when I got my hair cut in Patna, you know, you go into a salon,
and
it's just
like
men.
Nails are men.
Yeah, all the men who did the henna at the wedding, the mehdi, right? Yes, men. Wow, that is fascinating. That is such a great example because it's not just about the wages, but it's about this idea of culture. It's interacting with unrelated men. That is so brilliant. Why are you two not bigging yourselves up more? You two should be walking around with the biggest egos in Stanford. You'd be like, who is this Fukuyama guy? You'd be like, hey, we two are the here. That is great.
At least I can do that at MIT.
This is amazing. That is such a good... They really saw... They had as little... Because call center work is not hard, right?
It's supposed to be white collar.
Yes, exactly. And that is another great point about it's not saying, you know, what work do you think is fine for women to do? Are you fine with female employment? It's specifically about male honor, depending on women not relating to unrelated... Yeah. You know, not chatting to unrelated...
I mean, can you imagine an experiment where we give the same type of task on speech recording, but instead of giving general... recordings, we give them text that's like on women's health.
We were talking about doing this, and then it was like the woman will not do this if they have to like read aloud sentences about the periods, things like that. Like that will not be acceptable. So all of the sentences had to be sanitized.
We just didn't do that because there wasn't a market. Like the private sector may not need this type of work, so we were like that'll just make it too much more like academic than realistic, and so. But we do see like so much more rejection.
Okay, listen, ladies. I think you're barking up the wrong tree.
Which tree should we be barking
up? I want to direct you to the proper tree.
Listen.
You two know this. I love you very much, and I appreciate your work, and I'm a great fan of it. But let's think about this. But I think you know going forward, we need to recognize that these are cultural constraints. And so the big question is how can you change culture, right? Mm-hmm. And so that has to be it. So for me, you know, I'm wondering, can, you know, in Eliana Laferrera has this paper shown that telenovelas showing independent women surviving after divorce led to a rise in divorces. Yeah. And, you know, obviously the Indian caste system is very difficult because the caste system is, well, not, I shouldn't say difficult, but it's predicated on trusted networks whereby divorce is totally impermissible because otherwise it would destroy the caste system. And so, you know, but so it would be more difficult to have that kind of effect. But if you showed, you know, women working or women being independent or just had television shows that normalize female employment, just pumping people in Mumbai with lots and lots of videos of women working and nothing happening. You know, in the 1990s, there were lots of Bollywood shows about, you know, the sister being raped and then killed, and it was the man's task to avenge her honor and kill all the criminal network or everything. You know, there are lots and lots of Bollywood shows where it's about terrible things happening to women, instilling fear, or, you know, there are these bad things happening, or the mother-in-law is going to be controlled, or there's this tension between the wife and the mother-in-law, or there's this, you know, this man who's going to rape the woman. Like, what would happen if you just had a television show where there were a couple in Patna working together and they're very happy and they're supporting each other and they have a prosperous life and they're able... I mean, you have to have a little bit of melodrama to make it slightly interesting. I accept my TV show. They don't get the viewers hooked. But, like, I really think that if the bottom line is that there is a cultural thing, then the big question is, how do you change those cultural constraints? How do you make people feel that, one... the woman doesn't, or the you know, if the woman feels less obliged to obey her husband, and men feel that other people will support female employment. Like, those to me look like the binding constraints. Men have to be less worried about other people seeing their wives work, because otherwise nothing's going to change, right? To me, that's the big thing to change. So one option is more Bollywood shows highlighting just women working and men being totally okay with this, and couples thriving and people having the most fantastic life because the wife is working and it's not causing a problem, it's not causing a tension. Like, I mean, you know, my knowledge of Bollywood, I'm guessing, not to stereotype, is far more limited than yours. But, like, how confident are you in the idea? You know, I just think that television and storytelling can have a big impact. And I know that there are many progressive Bollywood shows, right? There are many, many progressive. But, you know, would it not be possible to have... Like, if you were going to fund an intervention, suppose you had $300 million and you could get Sharrock for your leading role or whatever. right? But like, what do you think about that idea of just showing women working and people being very happy and successful together and couples thriving? And you can tell that story in a very Indian way about family bonds and supporting each other. And, you know, because the elderly parents are old and the husband and wife support their both families and everyone is thriving. Mm-hmm. Like, you can tell a positive story, or maybe I'm being too naive.
Have you seen The Big City, like Satyajit Ray's movie? Movie about Calcutta that Abhijit at some point told me I should watch. He was like, "Oh, your paper is just like about this movie." Okay. I was like, "Okay, I'll check it out." And it's basically like about a kind of middle class family where the woman like persuades her husband, who like at first doesn't want her to work, to go out and get a job, and it like. There are problems, of course, but, like, it's overall, like, an uplifting, like, positive story about how, like, the couple kind of works together and, like, his parents aren't so happy about it, but, like, he's actually quite supportive and, like, in the end, she's, like, doing this job as a, selling, basically, like, appliances.
Has that helped? Has that done anything?
But I'm not sure. I mean, that's just, like, a one-off movie, but I think,
Because in Uzbekistan, where I was for a month last year, so many people told me about this TV show where the woman gets a job and then she becomes really uppity and she becomes really demanding. And if people are seeing those kind of dramas, they'd be like, this is what happened. You know, a lot of Indians tell me they were explain Indian culture to me through Bollywood films and they'll use those movies as evidence of what happens in real life, right? So they say, oh, well, let me explain this cultural phenomenon by reference to a film. And like in Uzbekistan, similarly, like people say, oh, you know what happens when a woman works, she becomes really uppity and really demanding and then the whole marriage tumbles. Like if you're getting lots of films whereby things go wrong after a woman works, then you're priming people to be super skeptical and super averse. So like when I was in, I spent a week in little villages in northern Bihar, and this was part of a Jivika and Mriga review. And I often chatted to women. I asked them, has a woman ever left this village for work? And they all said no. Like, they just had no idea. But, you know, imagine if they were shown like a long-running fun TV or film show where it's like, a couple lives in Patna and they're happy and they support each other and she's got a nice job. And like, you know, she looks like an aspirational woman and, you know, the woman's got nice saris and they're living comfortably. And like, you can create aspiration. Like, I just wonder if you can build aspirations.
Yeah. I think that in India, given that there are such high aspirations for the middle class in general and by youth unemployment is so high because there seem to be such high aspirations and there's such a gap with reality.
Yes.
Is that like somehow that bridge needs to be made and then providing the aspirational thing with that bridge is like, then I think we might we potentially could see translations in reality. Like, I'll give you one example that I've observed, which is different space toilet space sanitation. Where I was working in a tribal village in Raigarh in Maharashtra where nobody had a toilet. And this is like pre-Modi era. So this is like 2013. So before the toilets became a big thing. And before the toilet movie came out as well, which is what people now reference the Bollywood movie as everything. But in that village, nobody had this. And there were lots of videos and campaigns providing information to women and just households to build toilets. And they were like, it's really important to have toilets. And they all were like, yeah, it's really important to have toilets. But like, you did nothing about it. And they were even, in fact, given money from the government. Like the tribal funds have additional funding to get to build toilets. But they never did anything with it. And so I couldn't understand what was happening. And then for the longest time, I was like, okay, maybe they just don't know what this really is. I'm showing them videos. I'm showing them all this stuff. So then I took them on a field trip to Mumbai. And we just came in this like big bus, and then we like took them to the slums, which are dirtier than the village. Like it's much worse, of course, right? And so these people are like, oh my god, they're so cramped. But even in this cramped situation, when people were talking about how important toilets are for them and how much shameful it was that they didn't have individual toilets, and then they saw these fancy like tiled toilets that people had built, and they were like, oh, I can build it like this. And then they actually got talking about actually how much does it cost to build this. Women were crying. They went back and they built 4 toilets in the end of 2 months after that.
Wow.
It was like that sudden exposure and that like that literal bridge of being like, it's not just being shown, and I don't think it's like the other, like, yeah, it's like, it's great, but like, I don't know what to do about it. So even with these jobs, I think it's like, we can show them, and there's so many, and you're right, like, there's so many Bollywood movies and or lots of TV shows today that are showing progressive women.
Yes.
With a very positive influence on the rest of the family.
Yes, yes.
But somehow, the like women are consuming that information and feeling inspired with their role model, but not doing anything about it.
Right.
It just doesn't seem like they know what to do.
Yes, right. It's so like, I think this is a common thing said about Bollywood films, that it's like this sort of imaginary paradise that's not real, right? Yeah. And it's often about very rich people. And like, for example, the wonderful book, Desperately Seeking Sharrock, like all these women see Sharrock as their hero, but they know their own lives cannot be like that, right? So they idealize him as a very, you know, pro-female character, but they accept reality is very different. And so I think there are two things that can make a difference. One is showing relatable storylines. So if it's about women with a similar income bracket, right? But I think it can't just be like the superstars. It can't just be films about super successful women. It's got to be a relatable. There's a film in an intervention called Silence is Violence in Uganda, where they showed relatable women just like them reporting violence and being accepted by the community. And that led to much higher reporting of violence. So I definitely think it has to be relatable, not just like those fancy rich superstars who everyone knows lives a different life.
But like, so there was a Muslim show called Kabul Hai on television in India. I have loved Indian TV shows. I have watched like a lot. And so I would connect with girls in Hyderabad in schools who would not open up about domestic violence and things like in their that they've seen in their community. But the moment you started talking about Kabul Hai, and being like, Zoya, who's the main character, she refused to wear the burqa. And she was wearing jeans and a top and everything. Yeah. And those girls loved her. And these are all girls who were wearing a burqa to school. Or like the hijabs and everything. And they felt that this woman, Zoya, idolized this freedom. And they did. It was like she was relatable in that like she was living in similar communities. Yeah, like she came from like a poor family so on. And yet somehow, like they felt like this, they have felt this independence when they're talking to their friends. But became completely different when they were at home and had to live their real life.
Yes, yes.
Because they didn't, they still somehow didn't have the confidence to like be like, I want to wear jeans too.
But I sorry.
Oh, just something. Yeah. I feel like in both of the examples that Suhani just talked about, what's different, it seems like the role model or like the model that they're following, what seems like it made a difference is when it was someone who they actually saw in real life and who like they could, and it wasn't just like coming from TV. And it seems like clearly TV also can have effects in some cases, but to maybe have like someone in your community actually taking that action.
Let me say two things on this. I think that, so I would push back on the idea that it's women having role models and women needing confidence, because if we're saying the binding constraint is men's concern about disapproval, so it has to be men seeing or men believing that other men will support it. So it's not about women having role models. It's about men feeling that they won't be punished and ostracized and looked down upon and stigmatized by other men. That's like, I think so many development interventions get this wrong. Like if you look at all the interventions at the World Bank or if you look at the gender strategy, it's all about how can we empower women? And for me, that's a mistake. Like your data shows that, you know, almost 75% of women are saying yes to jobs. So women are not your binding constraint. Women's aspirations, women's desires, women's go-getting demand for jobs, that's not the problem.
Yeah.
So for me, the question is, how do you make men feel more comfortable about female employment?
Yeah.
And like, and this goes back to also what we were talking about, you know, people saying female, what employment is fine in general versus, you know, what you allow for your own wife. And this, for me, will be why the woman might be inspired or like love the woman who's being bold and defiant, right? But not want to do that in their own life because they worry about what their brothers will say, their fathers will say, their uncles. You know, I've interviewed many women in Turkey, Morocco and India who were heavily policed by their brothers. Heavily, like, you know, where are you, you know, show me WhatsApp proof of what you are, show me a video of where you are. So massive, heavily family policing. Yeah. And in these close-knit networks where everyone is, you know, watching what you're doing, you need to address the binding constraint, which is men's concern for disapproval.
That's very true. Yeah. So with sanitary napkins, yes, which is yes. where we have some experience, it was only women, but only once some of the husbands started to see that women are earning money now through this sanitary napkins business, they started to come out and be like, how can we help? Some of the more progressive husbands.
It was Padman in action. So,
that's very true. And those progressive Muslim husbands then came with us, and then we were like, can you sell sanitary napkins for us to other husbands and maybe even to the wives? And let's see how that goes. So we had these males selling and husbands of people in their community, mm-hmm. people mm-hmm. they knew. Mm-hmm. And the women would not talk to them. Women would be like, oh my God, I cannot talk to you. Mm-hmm. But they would refer them to their husbands. And now the husbands, the two husbands, the less maybe the one who's not yet informed and the more informed husband are now having a conversation about sanitary napkins. And they actually, like, some husbands just refuse to listen, but some husbands who were on the fence, like, they didn't know whether this is something appropriate, started to realize, oh, this is actually something more appropriate, and started to engage. So this idea, I think you're very right, that, like, involving, how can we change men's perceptions and attitudes and make them comfortable with it is an extremely important intervention. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are ways in which we can do that, which we haven't capitalized on enough, I think.
Maybe our next paper is about men.
Yes.
I think that's the tree Alice wants us to get to.
It's so true. And then we also hold now menstrual health sessions for men. Mm-hmm. Right? Raksha Bandhan, which is the festival for tying rakhis on sisters and brothers. So we invite all the brothers of different age groups. And the brothers gift their sisters at the end of the session a menstrual health kit. Mm-hmm. And they, to understand why it's important and what a woman goes through and how you should support your sister. And like, we held these sessions and we realized that, in fact, these sessions were most like highly attended. Mm. So women, there's huge levels of dropouts because women are not allowed and there's all these family constraints. Husbands are actually, they are like, the brothers actually come. And then when they come, they have such like clear attention. Like, they're not distracted. They're not giggling. Like, a lot of the women are often giggling and hiding their face and being like, I can't talk about this. I can't listen to this. The husbands are not like that, or the brothers. They were like, oh my God, I had no clue that my sister was going through this.
Wow.
And they actually listen. So we now have a program called Boys Care Too. And so we do this now in colleges and schools, and the boys are very aptly listening to this, like their attention. With
That's amazing. And what I like about that is in some cultures where men see themselves as the providers, the ones who take the care, you know, they take it on their shoulders to look after their families, right? And I think that's an important thing to recognize, that men see it as their responsibility to be like the tree, right? Yeah. To be the tree that, you know, with the strong branches, looking after their family, being strong for their family. Yeah. So when, if, you know, it's possible to maybe get traction, the idea that men feel this is their responsibility, this is how they understand the needs of their family, the needs, you know, what their family is about. Because that can be, there could be a narrative about male pride in looking after your family, and this is your responsibility, and these women have these issues. And, you know, just opening up, talking about menstrual health, you know, in some communities in Maharashtra that I spoke to, you know, women, you know, being sent outside the house while they're on their period, or being forced to lie on the ground, or not being allowed in the kitchen, not being allowed to touch stuff, just like being treated as you're dirty. Yeah. Like, I for some people, you know, outside cultures, you know, I think globally menstrual health is a taboo. Globally, you know, in the West, you know, girls can be very embarrassed about their periods. Yeah. Yeah. But especially in culture where there is a big, like, women can be made to feel that they're filthy, that they're dirty, that they're impure. And I think this can be part of what actually reinforces patriarchy. If you are telling people once a month that you are less pure and that, you know, you're not attaining these high levels of spirituality, that actually legitimizes patriarchy, right? Yeah. Because the person is impure and the whole religion is based on purity, right? So I think you know, reducing the shame of stigma, getting men to think about, that's amazing. Suhani, again, you are giving us more gold nuggets. That's brilliant. That's super, super brilliant.
And that's like not even part of your... That's just like Suhani's second life.
Listen, you two, it has been an absolute pleasure chatting to both of you, learning from both of you, learning about all these naughty things you kept but did not tell us.
But I think you two are going to be absolute superstars in the future, and you are going to produce so many glorious trees. And I will be your biggest champion, and I will look forward to learning from you in the future.
Yeah.
So, big congratulations, okay?
Thank you.
Any advice from you, we're very happy to keep talking.
All right, yeah, I will give you full instructions. Full instructions. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Alice.
Bye.